Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
Hey, let's jump right into this. Joining us on our KTAR Newsmaker line is Thad Bingle. Thad is with Command Group founding partner and the former chief of staff for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Thank you very much for joining us today, Mr. Bingle.
Great to be with you, Bruce.
So, obviously, talk about your wheelhouse and the world that you live in with border protection, security, and what's been going on down there. We want to jump in and ask you right now, from your time with Customs and Border Protection and with your time now in the private sector working, can you tell us what has changed along our southern border? Has something changed recently that has led to this, what some people are calling a crisis?
Well, the biggest change to point out, first of all, is where the recent wave of immigrants, and by recent, I mean starting really 2012 was really the turning point, mm-hmm. where they were coming from. When I left at the end of the Bush administration in 2009, out of our total Southwest border apprehensions, we had 716,000 of those that year were Mexican. And only 92,000 were from these Central American countries. Our entire infrastructure was built to hold people for basically 48 hours at a maximum at Border Patrol stations so they could be processed, turned right back over across the border to Mexico. And only the few that were subject to criminal prosecution or who were claiming asylum might be detained longer. That really started to change during the Obama administration. In 2014, we went to 283,000 Central Americans that year. So nearly, triple the amount. And unlike Mexicans, we cannot voluntarily repatriate them to Mexico. Mexico, right. Even if they cross, will not accept them back. That was a radical change. And we didn't get in front of it then. And we're paying the price still today because we didn't build the long-term detention capacity, along with some court decisions and settlements that meant we had to turn people over, especially minors, within a certain amount of time. That's what's making this so different than what we were seeing in Arizona 10 years ago.
We're talking with Thad Bingle. He's with Command Group founding partner and a former chief of staff for U.S. Customs and Border Protection. At that, my question, though, is the separation of children from their parents. I haven't heard it reach this fever pitch in previous administrations. It seems as though there was a change in policy by the Trump administration some 6 weeks ago. And I'm curious as to how previous administrations, you talked about the Bush administration, a little bit of the Obama administration, how did those administrations handle families crossing the border, seeking asylum? Because it's been happening for a long time.
Yeah.
This isn't the first administration.
Yeah,
so how did previous administrations handle this situation?
Well, again, the numbers have pretty radically changed, starting with first unaccompanied minors that were showing up in 2013, 2014 was a radical change for what we had seen before. Now, we did have family units always, some of them seeking asylum, some of them we were able to keep together because, again, we were turning them right back over as Mexican nationals to Mexico within 48 hours. So there was never a separation issue. We also didn't have, one of the things that's causing the current crisis is being described is that, you're trying to criminally prosecute people who are not showing up at the port of entry to claim asylum, but are crossing illegally between the ports of entry. And now, because of these court decisions and settlement agreements that have happened in the interim since 2009, in many cases, you now have to, for parents you're going to criminally prosecute, you can't keep their children together. The rules say you can only keep the children for 72 hours, and then DHS has to turn them over to another cabinet department, HHS. And it says we can only maintain a family together in holding for 20 days maximum, and our family holding capacity is maxed out. So, these date strictures, some of them were not in place before, and we've never encountered family units at this level from other than Mexico. And that's what's really, it's really a complete breakdown of the system that if we had built family detention capacity years ago, mm-hmm. we might have been able to handle this, but even with that detention capacity, our limits on how long we can hold people as a family when you're trying to repatriate the family, you can only hold the children there for 72 hours. That really puts a restriction on what you can do and where you can keep them.
Fair to say. Thad Bingle, again, a former chief of staff for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, helping add some context to it. And you mentioned the people who have crossed illegally, even if they are looking or attempting to apply for or present themselves, I don't know the proper terminology, for asylum. We're hearing stories of, and there are reports of, even at legal ports of entry, that people who are attempting to present themselves for asylum, they're even having difficulty doing that. Is that still the system is just overwhelmed?
Well, I think the system is still a bit overwhelmed, but that's still a far better alternative than trying to do this between the ports of entry. You know, the process that you should follow if you were seeking to asylum is to turn yourself over at a port of entry. You may be told to come back the next day and apply because they're overwhelmed, but that's the system they're trying to push everyone towards so that you don't encounter this detention problem and you don't have to be separating families from children. I know that's not what anyone wants to do. But the big goal here, too, again, that we have to keep in mind is ultimately all of this is about trying to not only enforce our border security at the border with anyone who would cross illegally, but we're trying to send a clear message to discourage people from ever starting this journey from Central America in the beginning. As tragic as it may be to keep families and children apart temporarily in what are, you know, basic but safe facilities, you know, how many lives are lost on that journey through Mexico? You know, if this saves one child from drowning in the Rio Grande, if it saves one five-year-old from dying in the desert, you know, in Sonora, if it saves one teenager from being raped from Central America on her way through Mexico, you know, what's the alternative? You know, that's the behavior we're trying to discourage, is parents putting themselves and their children at risk with dangerous drug cartels and human trafficking organizations through Mexico.
But Thad, we also have a lot of parents who are leaving really violent, dangerous situations in Central America to save the lives of their family and their children, and they're willing to risk their lives and their children's lives on that very dangerous journey.
They think all those things are
Mexico.
Still better.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, we're in a very precarious situation here. I get the whole idea of if you want asylum, do it the right way. Cross through a port of entry, you may be turned around and said, you got to come back tomorrow because we don't have the resources to handle it today. We're seeing stories of lines and lines and lines of people who they've been in line for 2 days and one person has been interviewed for asylum. So as the government is promising to prosecute anyone who seeks asylum the wrong way by crossing into the U.S. illegally, it's also raising some serious questions about just how possible is it to seek asylum the right way?
Well, that's a very valid point, and they need to figure that out. They need to do more. If you're going to say this is the right way to do it, then that has to be a way that's accessible, and you have to have some confidence that you're going to see an immigration official, you're going to be able to file a claim, you're going to have some certainty about the way it's going to move through a legal determination process in front of a judge. You know, all those things need to happen, and it could start actually in Central America. You pointed out the conditions, and I've been there. You know, It's levels of abject poverty and crime that, you know, that we would shudder at here in some of these countries. So that's a very real problem. And where I maybe differ from some of the current policymakers is, you know, we undertook pretty significant foreign aid initiatives with Colombia and with Mexico. There were teetering on the verge of being failed states in a lot of the same ways. And Merida and Plan Colombia, you know, really made a difference by propping up some of the civil institutions in those countries and providing aid that caused people to stay home instead of flood out of their country as refugees. And, you know, more of that needs to be done. The impact of a dollar spent there is far greater than the dollar we're spending to detain people here in the U.S.
Yeah, I that's a wonderful point. Again, Thad Bingle, former chief of staff of U.S. Customs and Border Protection, it's one that it may not be a popular discussion to have, but what I hear you say, and I've seen some of the numbers before, it's kind of a pay me now, pay me later kind of argument. You either encourage them not to leave El Salvador, as an example, by investing in and making El Salvador a place that they feel least safe to live in, or you can deal with them on the border, but you're going to deal with it one way or the other.
Absolutely, Bruce. That's the reality, you know. And we can either ignore reality and say, well, they'll just stop coming if all we do is make it tougher.
Yeah.
They're not, you know.
Yeah.
They won't stop coming, and we can do more with Mexico too, to work with them to discourage people, you know, using their country as a transit zone to get themselves here, including, you know, they need to look at what they do for, mm-hmm. for handling asylum requests from people from neighboring countries as well. You know, they're pretty tough. Maybe they could accept some people who are legitimately experiencing, you know, threats to their life and safety.
Mr. Bingle, thank you very much. I feel like calling you that. I feel like we're friends now, but I sincerely appreciate really a thoughtful and an interesting look at what's going on. Again, Thad Bingle, Command Group founding partner and a former chief of staff for the U.S. Customs and Border Protection, making some great points, Pamela.
Yeah, points that I hadn't heard raised anywhere else, and he just did so right here that had me thinking a little differently,
yeah.
Bruce. And that was, back in 2012, when you looked at the amount of people crossing the border illegally or seeking asylum, the vast majority of them were Mexicans.
Right.
So if they were caught illegally or were refused asylum, we were able to
easy
repatriate
to turn them around,
them.
Walk them back across
we
the Nogales border.
Able to repatriate them back to Mexico. Now we're seeing the vast majority of people seeking those two avenues coming from Central America. It's not as easy to turn them around. We just can't send them to Mexico.
Different people showing up at the border causing a different issue.
And that is amazing. All right.
So where are we? And again, thanks a lot to Thad Bingle. I thought that was amazing. We're going to have to talk to him again. I guarantee he's going to have more information as this story continues to evolve. Where are we with the legalization of marijuana in the state of Arizona? We have some polling numbers out we're going to share with you.
Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
Okay, I'm going to admit I'm not 100% sure. I know that last election, the last general election we had almost 2 years ago, legalized marijuana was on the ballot. We were one of a bunch of states, and if I remember correctly, Pamela, we were the only state where legalized recreational marijuana lost.
Yeah, the ballot measure in 2016 was defeated, narrow margin, 51%.
That's as narrow as it gets, right? There is a move to put it back on the ballot again. It requires signatures. We understand they're in the process of it. They haven't presented them yet. Is that correct?
Right. They have until sometime in July to present the 150,000, you know, verifiable signatures.
So you may have the opportunity to vote once again for or against legalized recreational marijuana. But we do have some new polling data from the local polling company, OH Predictive Insights, about where people are.
Yeah, because again, when you take a look at what happened in 2016, it was narrowly defeated. It's most likely going to end up on the ballot again here in November. So will it pass? Will recreational marijuana pass in a midterm election? And Mike Noble of OH Predictive Insights, who we've had here on the show quite a few times, says this: absolutely not.
Really?
In a midterm election.
In a midterm.
Here's why.
Okay.
When you look at the people who actually vote in a midterm election, they're older, more conservative.
Okay.
They're not necessarily your recreational marijuana supporting kind of crowd.
They don't strike me as so in your demo description.
Yeah, that you may see during a general election, you know. So he says it's not going to pass in the midterm, but he said, look for it again in 2020, that it will be there again in 2020.
And you got to believe, again, if public opinion has been changing on this, and it hasn't been going towards more illegal. It's been going towards legalization, if you will. And so even if it doesn't win in a midterm, just based on the type of demographics, and let's be honest, it's that could still change. Also, this isn't going to be your typical midterm. There's a lot of issues that might draw people to the polls. And would legalized marijuana be one of the issues that people show up to vote for?
You know, I think that this midterm election is actually, at least here in the state of Arizona, proving to be very interesting, because you look as though right now you're going to have a recreational marijuana proposal, okay, that isn't verified yet, but everything is kind of pointing towards
that they're
going to
get the
case.
Yeah.
You have some other really interesting proposals that are going to be out there as well, or propositions rather, that people I think are going to go vote on that they may otherwise not have gone and voted in a midterm election. And those are surrounding education. Mm-hmm. When we had the whole Red for Ed movement,
sure,
schools shutting down all across this state, we know that a lot of the signs that you saw out there on the Capitol lawn was remember in November.
Yeah,
remember
yeah,
in November.
Yeah.
You had a lot of educators who have become politically active, whether they have decided to sign up and run for office themselves or have taken detailed notes as to who voted in favor of education measures.
Checking their list twice,
yes,
okay?
Finding out who's naughty and nice, and they plan on going out to vote. Not just for their elected political heroes, but also for some of these other propositions. The propositions as to whether or not you want taxpayer-funded dollars going to fund private schools through mm-hmm. voucher programs. There's another proposal that you've got going on about taxing the rich to pay for education. So I think you're going to have a lot of people going to the midterm election for education if they also have a chance to vote yeah. on recreational marijuana. It could make for a very interesting season.
I remember that we had a chance to talk about it during the whole Red for Ed, that legalizing marijuana and taxing it is not a solution to the education shortfall. That looking at like the numbers that Colorado had generated, it's like 3% of the budget. You know what I'm saying? This isn't like all of a sudden they're going to start gold plating the water fountains. It ain't that much money. It's money, don't get me wrong, but it's not the type of money that they're talking about. So a lot of parents are reasonably concerned about the amount of screen time their kids are spending. But should you be a little more concerned about the amount of time you're spending glued to a screen? Parents' screen time. Talking about it next on Arizona's News Station.
Arizona's News Station. KTAR News on 92.3 FM. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes.
So there's been plenty of talk about kids today with a screen in their face at all times, be it a phone or a tablet or a laptop or a television or whatever, and screen time. And the talk about how to balance screen time with, you know, get outside and kick a damn ball, kid. But one of the things that isn't talked about nearly as much, Pamela, is the amount of screen time the parents are exposed to.
Yeah, you know what? We talk about the challenges of being so connected with your phone and having a screen in your face. Sleep disturbances, right? You lose some empathy. Car crashes. All kinds of things. Hurting your relationship. And a lot of times we spend so much time and effort talking about screen time impact on kids. How much screen time is too much screen time? How do you manage screen time in your home? And so we talk about kids, but surprisingly, little attention is actually paid to screen use by parents themselves. And now you've got technology experts out there who are saying parents are suffering from something called continuous partial attention. That when you are sitting down with your child only has part of your attention.
Oh.
And then sometimes the lengths children will go to, especially young children, to get that attention back. And so parents who are constantly, they may be physically present in their child's life.
Sure.
Because when you think about it right now,
they're sitting on the couch next to them.
Parents right now actually have more FaceTime with their kids than almost any other parents in history. Surprisingly enough, even though considering that more and more women are in the workforce.
But we've changed the definition of work. We've certainly changed how hours. Okay, I get it. I get it.
Moms actually have more time and spend more time caring for their kids today than the mothers of the 1960s.
Solid.
Yet,
uh-oh,
we're physically there, but we're not emotionally attuned to kids because we're not mentally there.
We're just as distracted as the kids we shake our fist at there. You know, there. I think there's something. I put it this way. You also model behavior for your kids.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's one thing to go, you kids today need to go outside and play, and you need to put down the video game controller and stop playing Pokemon whatever on your phone. while your face is in your phone and you don't even look up when you're ordering your kids around to not do the thing that you do all the time. Like, there is a certain, well, mommy tells me not to do this, but she seems like, we talk about like distracted driving. Like, you know, you kids have to learn good behavior, says mom while looking at her phone driving down the 51.
Now, granted, my perspective is a little different because I've got an 8-year-old. So she doesn't have a cell phone herself. It's not as though I have a 14, 15-year-old who has their face buried in their cell phone all the time. But it breaks my heart when we go out to a restaurant. Now, whether that restaurant is a McDonald's or whether that restaurant is a pita jungle, when I look around, routinely, I see children, young children, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, again, not your teenagers, who are sitting at the table with mom or dad or both mom and dad with their face buried in the cell phone.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like your child is sitting right across from you. Pay them a little attention, would you? Now, granted, I'm not perfect, okay? I'm not trying to cast the first stone here. I find myself doing this sometimes as well, but then it registers to me because I want to model that kind of behavior for my daughter. I do not want her glued to technology. I set those boundaries for her. It is a constant conversation in our house.
You'll acknowledge it's real hard, the do as I say, not what I do.
Oh, because, absolutely.
Because those distractions that we shake our fist at and yell at kids about are the same distractions for adults.
Oh, yeah.
They're the same challenges that kids have. And I think just as many adults have difficulty prying themselves away, but they justify it. Well, but I'm watching the History Channel. I'm not watching Nick at Night. You know, well, guess what? I don't even know if Nick at Night's still on, by the way. But guess what? You're still glued to a TV screen. You know, you're on your phone doing whatever you justify doing. They're on their phone doing whatever they justify doing. The reality is you're both got your eyes down on into a screen.
So, you know, when you have younger children and you give your phone more attention than you give your child the attention, you really got to think of what message that sends them.
Mm-hmm.
When you have teenagers, though, and your phone, your nose is buried in a phone, what do you think they're going to do? They're going to pick up their phone. I mean, as adults, you're sitting at a dinner table and somebody else picks up their phone. An adult picks up their phone.
What do you do?
What do you do? You pick up your phone as well. Do you not think that that's what your teenager is going to do? They absorb what you do as well. So while I do think that having a conversation about the amount of screen time kids have, it's also really important, I think, for parents to look in the mirror and go, where are they getting that from?
You know, I didn't even think about this, and shout out to Don on the Twitter machine
for
pointing this out. Many of you might have gone and seen Incredibles 2 over the weekend, largest animated opening. The premise of the film is that the adults become hypnotized by screen slaver. By watching their screens, the screen slaver manages to hack into screens, and this is where the flashing lights they were worried about epileptic seizures, and hypnotize and take over
the adults
because the adults were all
wow
on the screens, and it was the kids that had to save them because they weren't affected by staring at a computer screen or their phone all the time.
Yeah.
Interesting. I hadn't thought
Pixar
that. No,
on
that
to
is really
there.
That was a really solid pickup on there. You know, I hadn't thought about it in that context. But you see this constantly, and I wish I knew what the good answer was, because I think it just takes so much self control to not reach for the phone, to not use the tablet to entertain yourself and or your kids.
Yeah, and setting some limit, you know, we all too, not too often.
I don't like limits.
But we set boundaries and limits for our children, which as parents you should do. But have you ever considered setting some boundaries and limits on your own screen time?
No, you lost me at my house.
You don't have kids either, so it's a little bit different. You don't have a little one soaking up everything that you do, and thank God for that. My goodness. Can you imagine?
How about that?
A little Bruce?
How about a shout out for
that? Holy cow.
So how would you like to travel the world and live in amazing places for free?
Yes, please.
Okay, it's a thing. And if we're not here tomorrow, it's because we signed up for it. We'll tell you about it.
We're doing a show from Spain.
Yeah, that's coming up next on Arizona's News Station.
Get some perspective. Bruce St. James and Pamela Hughes. KTAR News on 92.3 FM.
So it's probably a pretty common wish or goal. You know, travel the world, see amazing places, and preferably do so on the cheap. Well, there are some people out there that you can make an argument, Pamela. They have hacked life.
I know. This is amazing.
Hashtag winning.
Yeah. You know, when I was 26, 28 years old, this wasn't even an option. But you have a lot of young people, millennials, who are, like you said, hacking life. And it's kind of like this new aspect of the sharing economy. We hear of, like, you know, ride sharing,
yeah,
or, you know, car sharing or bike sharing or things along those lines. But there's something called TrustedHouseSitters.com. These two guys, and this story is just written about these two guys, but I know that there are a ton of other young people out there doing this. But we have Ben and Mario, who have spent the last 18 months traveling the world. Sounds great, right? They've been in Sydney. They've been in Seoul, South Korea. Sounds like an expensive vacation, except they have been house-sitting for people all over the globe.
Oh, that's a thing.
Well, I know that, like, there's house-sitting is a thing.
House-sitting
is a thing. And when I think of, like, house-sitting, I think of, like, okay, hey, you know, I'm going to be out of town for a week.
International house-sitting. I'm just worried that, like, it's like an Airbnb, and I'd sign up for some international house-sitting, and I'd get some thatched hut, you know, somewhere. And it's five-star, but, hey, that's five-star here. You know, hey, it's got a roof.
So they stay in somebody's house, kind of like an Airbnb, right?
Got it.
Somebody's vacant home. They say it can last anywhere from a few days to a month. They watch the dogs, feed the cats, water the plants, keep an eye on the house. Well, the homeowners are gone. They do so for free. They got a free place to stay. They're like, it's like staying at a friend's house.
Yeah.
You know, more comfortable.
Yeah.
And they're getting to travel the world. Now, they're also working. So these two have jobs where it doesn't matter where they work. They just need to have a Wi-Fi connection, and they can get their job done.
That's been a big change. Because before, if you were going to do something like that, you were off the grid. You won't remember this, Pamela. You couldn't even afford long-distance phone calls. Nobody could, okay? Nobody could. It was like, how much is it? It's $18 a minute. Don't hang up the phone, for God's sake. So nowadays, with the internet, does it matter to your boss if you're sitting in South Korea or Sydney, Australia or South Africa, as long as you get your job done?
Yeah, and I think that that's just how life and lifestyles have changed over the year. I mean,
yeah,
over the years, rather. You were a former boss, program director at some radio stations here in the Valley as well as on the West Coast. And you would have these, like, and I know this because I've been in management here at KTIR, you would have the execs from other radio stations or corporate come into town, and they might be in town for a week, so they're all at hotels and they're renting cars
and everything,
dinners,
yeah,
and all kinds of, and it's a big expense.
Oh, it's amazing. I remember seeing the line item for the budget.
One way that, like, work has changed is a lot of times people are just having conference calls, you know, online.
You can do the
video
webinars,
yeah,
you know,
doing
and
the
things where
video conferences. So you're not even having the travel expenses.
No.
But if somebody does travel into town, they're not, like, necessarily renting a car. They're Ubering it everywhere.
And, yeah.
Everything just seems to have changed.
There is some fundamental changes. You know, can I tell you a quick story? Only because when I think of house sitters, I only have one example in my life of a house sitter. Shout out to Julie. When I lived in L.A., Julie, I was picking her up to go something. Here's the address. Okay, it's on Mulholland Drive. If you don't know Los Angeles, like, Mulholland, that's a little ritzy. That's up on top of the mountain there, you know, the Hollywood Hills. You're like, Mulholland. I pull up at the house. It's a big house. I was like, maybe Julie's loaded, and I didn't know it. Suddenly, she got better looking in my eyes. I walk up to the house, Pamela, and there's a guy in the garden, and he looks like Alex Trebek. You know the guy from Jeopardy? Right?
Mm-hmm. I know who he is.
Right? And I walk in the house and I'm like, hey, I go, well, this is a really nice place. By the way, did you know your gardener looks like Alex Trebek? She goes, it is Alex Trebek.
Okay.
I said, Alex Trebek is your gardener? She goes, no, this is Alex Trebek's house. I'm house sitting. It's for sale. And he's just sprucing up because there's going to be people coming over to look at the house. And I go, wait a minute. You don't live here? And she goes, no, I just go from house to house to house. She goes, I move every couple of months. And she goes, I do nothing but house sit in these multi-million dollar homes in Los Angeles.
Not a bad gig if you can get it.
Shout out to you. That is all kinds of awesome.
But again, it just gets back to like a different way of thinking and even approaching life. Like these two guys, they work remotely for an online language instruction company. They earn about $23,000 a year between the two of them. All right.
They're not working full time.
No,
let's get that out of the way. Right?
You know, they do some translating, you know, anywhere from $400 to $1,000 a month. So they have a budget, but because of the way that they're living, they make it work. And this is a priority for them, so they can make it work. I just thought it was super cool.
That is
a different way to travel around the world as a house sitter.
House sitting. There's got to be a website for that. I should look into it. Again, I'm going to get a thatched roof hut somewhere. I just know it. Just know it. It looked nice in the pictures. Check out the headlines on the way. We have audio of kids inside these detention facilities. How did we get to this point? We're talking about it next on Arizona's News Station.